Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Hello, welcome to Cutting the Curd. This is Jessica. My guest is Benita Casbo, owner and cheesemaker at Casbo's Market, based in Madison, New Jersey. Benita is originally from Syria, and she specializes in making jibna. Her old world recipe for this cheese is made with a unique spice that we're going to get into the details of in a little bit. She is passionate about Middle Eastern food, and she enjoys helping people discover the traditional flavors of the Middle East. I'm so excited to introduce Benita to the Cutting the Curd audience. Audience, welcome Benita to Cutting the Curd. I'm so happy to have you.
Thank you so much, Jessica, for having me. I'm so excited. I really appreciate you asking me to be on here today.
Well, I have to say, you know, the timing is really great. One, because, you know, there's more of a conversation going on in the cheese industry about the Eurocentricity of the conversation around cheese and challenging that, pushing back on that to make sure that we're recognizing the dairy traditions from all parts of the world. And I had that in my mind, you know, I always have it in my mind, but then I came across a few different posts about your cheese, about jibna, and about it in a market, about its availability near me, about your participation in some local events. And then we found out we know all these people in common, and it was just like in the air.
Yeah.
And so I am so happy that something that's kind of in the conversation in our part of New York and New Jersey, we now are able to share it with everyone listening to Cutting the Curd. So can you tell us, what is jibna?
Sure. So jibna, first, I just want to make it clear for everyone to understand, that's actually just the word for cheese. And so in the word jibna in Arabic means cheese. So when I started the company, I wanted to help expand people's vocabulary around Middle Eastern food. And so when you look at my product labeling, it says jibna Syrian cheese. And my recipe in particular is my family's recipe. I'm originally from Aleppo, Syria. And I'll be truthful with you, I didn't know what to call it. And I said, you know, I didn't want to give it a generic name that wouldn't connect back. And I wanted to be very clear about where I'm from. So, you know, we just know it growing up as jibna. And so I connected that with Syrian cheese. So that way people would understand that this is something that has Syrian roots.
Interesting that you even talk about how labeling it, you chose to call it Syrian cheese to like give so much context to somebody who may not be familiar with it at all.
Yes, exactly. So that's really important to me, because I also see in the market that there isn't a ton of representation of Middle Eastern foods that are properly labeled, I would say. I think that, you know, and I know we'll get into this a little bit later, but just how the dialect is not very clear about where things are from, or, you know, where's that recipe cultivated from. And so I really wanted it to be very clear. And that's why I chose Jibneh Syrian cheese as what the product is. And, you know, I'm happy to share with you, you know, what that means. Like, what is a Syrian cheese? What is a Middle Eastern cheese?
Let's go for it. Yeah, so let's do that.
That's what I'm looking to do. Sure. So Jibneh can be, you know, like I said, it's the word cheese. However, there are different cheeses that come from the Middle East. Jibneh starts off with a cow's milk curd. And to be truthful, I don't make the curd myself. I'm manipulating existing curd to taste the way people enjoy it when they purchase it. I'm taking that curd and it is a cow's milk. It's whole milk. And I cut it into blocks. I try my best to cut them at 1/3 of a pound, but you know, I'm not a machine and I do everything by hand. So we try our best. And then it gets rolled in salt. And then what I do is I place the curd, the salted curd, on top of baking trays that have the racks on them. Mm-hmm. And then I let them sit for hours. And once that time is up, the appropriate amount of time, then those cubes get cooked, and they get cooked in boiling water, and they are seasoned with something called mahleb. And mahleb is a unique spice that is native to the Middle East. And if you'd like, I can tell you exactly what it is. You know,
would love to hear it. Yeah,
sure. So mahleb is derived from seeds of cherry pits that are native to the Middle East, and they look like little seeds, little kernels. Some people describe them as kernels. And I take those seeds or kernels and I grind them into a very fine powder. And that is what gives Jibneh the flavor that you're getting. And the way I describe it is, it's almost like when I'm cooking it, it's almost like it creates an aroma of like marzipan.
Oh, wow.
Like a nutty aroma that's slightly floral. And then when you eat the Jibneh, you're going to get that same taste. I've had so many variations of what people tell me they taste, which is one of the fun things, is that people will say to me, what is that? I don't know what that is. I like it a lot, but I can't describe it. And then I'll start giving them some words and they're like, oh yeah. So some people say floral, some people say nutty, some people say almondy. I've had some people say cinnamon. It also has like chamomile notes to it. Mm. That's like that floral type of taste. So I think depending on your palate, that's the flavor profile that you're going to get that the mahleb creates within the cheese itself.
So what is the texture of Jibneh?
So it's harder than a dry mozzarella, but softer than a cheddar. It's somewhere in between. So it's firm. It's not going to crumble like feta, but you are going to get a saltiness to it. And so I always joke and say that it's like feta meets halloumi. And right. When I say feta, I mean more of the, not quite as salty, but it's going to have a firmness to it. And then halloumi, because of that, like texture, not so squeaky, just more of this like interesting firmness that stays in your mouth. And then as you're chewing it, it starts to break down. And then what's interesting about it is the flavor hits you on the back. You don't get it initially. I've had so many people say to me, I don't taste anything. And I say, just keep chewing, like don't swallow. and I know that I'm sure, you know, as a cheese person, right, you have to let things sit on your palate. You can't just like dive in and just let it go down. You really have to let it sit and, you know, and just enjoy it. And you get all the flavor on the back end. And people tell me, oh my gosh, it's like still in my throat, or it's still in the back of my mouth. And the flavor is developing the more it's sitting on my tongue.
And does it melt? Can you
melt
it?
Oh my gosh. So it melts incredibly well. So even though I remove a lot of the moisture from the curd, you are still able to have supreme meltability. I kid you not, we do like cheese pull contests in my house. One time we got a cheese pull of Jibneh that was 2 feet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it melts incredibly well. And here's the interesting thing about it. When you melt it, it tastes like a different cheese than when you eat it as like just like a little piece of cheese.
Well, I was going to ask you, when you were describing the flavor, And then pointing out that the flavor is almost on like the back of the palate. Does it interact with other flavors? Does interacting with other flavors from other foods that you may use with it change the way Jibna tastes? And it sounds like maybe temperature does too.
Oh, absolutely. So depending on how you pair it, it will taste different to you. And what I like to do, and I know we're going to, you know, hopefully talk about some of the ways that I do marketing, is I like to give people all the options. And one thing that that does is not only does it introduce you to all these great flavors, but it shows you how do you incorporate Jibna into your eating, right? Because what I've learned is people don't know. They don't know what to do with something new. And I also like to give the customer or the user the ways of eating it in a traditional manner. I think that that is really important to the story, to the history, and it just teaches people how to, you know, try something new in their kitchen. But traditionally, we eat it with cucumbers. We'll eat it with tomato. You know, we love apricot jam in the Middle East, fig jam. You know, even cherry jam is beautiful with it. Also, it's amazing with cantaloupe, watermelon. It's incredible. It's so good. And you get these different flavor notes depending on the pairing, and you're kind of utilizing all your taste buds with it.
Amazing. I want you to definitely tell us about how you became a cheesemaker, because that is now your vocation. That is what you're doing. Welcome to the cheese industry. But I do want to backtrack a little bit, because you're talking about some unique ingredients like the matlab, and also finding a market for the Jibna. And maybe even I would push it to say finding a mainstream market outside of some of the more Middle Eastern markets. And we are in the New York, New Jersey metro area. I mentioned that at the beginning. So where do you find the matlab?
So the matlab, it is available online, but I don't purchase it online. I actually go to Patterson, where I grew up, and they have Middle Eastern markets, and they have it imported from the Middle East, and that's where I get it from.
And is there a big Middle Eastern community in Patterson?
Oh, huge Middle Eastern community. I would say when I lived there, it was maybe like 60% Middle Eastern. And I would say now it's about 90% Middle Eastern. And, wow. And the town that I grew up in, it's actually a city. It's a big city, and there's different pockets of communities depending on which neighborhood you're in. And the neighborhood that I grew up in was the one that had a huge Middle Eastern population. And now it's I would say almost 100%.
So tell us a little bit more about your background and how you ended up on this cheesemaking path. You mentioned you were born in Aleppo and you grew up in Patterson. So how did you become a cheesemaker?
Yeah. So this was the cheese of my childhood. I ate this, you know, my whole life. It was a staple, and cheese is a staple in Middle Eastern households. I don't think, you know, we're known for that. But I learned how to make it at home, with my family. And then, when I grew up and I got married and I had my own family, I wanted them to always have it in the fridge like I did. And I just started making it, and, you know, I would make, you know, 10 pounds at a time, 20 pounds at a time.
Wow.
And I would just, I would make it like every month for them, or, you know, whatever. Cause my family, we eat it every day. It's,
what is the shelf life of this cheese?
So, so in the store, right now, because it's not vacuum sealed, it's just in a loose plastic packaging. Mm-hmm. It's 5 weeks.
Oh, wow. Okay. Because when you were talking about the amounts that you're making, I think there's also one, that it's going to last, and two, you're consuming a lot of it on a regular basis.
Yes. Yes. So we, you know, in my house, we go through a lot of it. It's in my kids' lunch boxes every day. They have it for breakfast. You know, if someone's running out the door for a sport, they might have it as a snack. So we go through a lot, and, you know, we're not a small family. So, so we go through a lot of cheese between all of us. So I, like I was saying, I started, you know, making it for my family, and, this is a funny story. one day went to ShopRite to pick up my children's birthday cake. And I meet a woman who's sampling cheese. And she was lovely. And I said to her, oh, I make cheese too. And she said, well, what kind of cheese do you make? And I said, well, it's Syrian cheese. And she was from upstate New York. And she's like, oh my gosh, I would love to try it. And I said, oh, I'll go get it for you. I went home and I got it. And I said to my husband, here's the cake, but I'll be right back. And then he's like, what are you doing? I said, I'm taking the gibnet. This woman wants to try it. So I gave her the cheese and she gave me her card and she said, oh, I'll call you in a few days. And I said, okay. So she calls me up and I kid you not, she said to me, this is so fantastic. She said, I grew up around Middle Eastern people. And she said, can I buy the recipe from you?
Wow.
And I was shocked. I was like, wow. I was like, no, I can't sell you the recipe.
That's right.
I was like, I can't do that. And she said, well, listen, I know you don't know me. And she goes, and I make cheese, but I encourage you to do this. And she said, you know, I think people should know about this. And I said, well, thank you. And so she encouraged me and I said, okay. And, so then other things happened at the same time. This was years ago. The Syrian refugee crisis was kind of at its all-time high. And we have a really lovely community here in New Jersey that started hosting Syrian refugee dinners. And I don't know if you've seen it. It was in the New York Times and it became a thing around here.
Yes. And, yes. I think mm-hmm. Maplewood, I think.
Maplewood and South Orange. Yes, exactly.
Yes. And I highly recommend that people go on the archives for New York Times. You should look it up and read about that project because it was really wonderful.
It was incredible. And so one day I'm on Facebook and I see we need someone who speaks Arabic to come to one of these dinners. We don't have someone and we need a translator. So there was no way I could say no. Obviously, you know, it's obviously very difficult when you're from that part of the world and you see what's happening to, you know, your community. And so I immediately replied and I said, I'll do it. I speak Arabic, whatever you need, I'll do. So I started volunteering for these dinners and I did multiples of them. I started coordinating all of the charitable donations for the family, doing the deliveries for the family. And then, you know, unfortunately the tone of the country at that time was very, very negative. And I said to myself, you know what, this woman, Sharon, encouraged me to do this. She said, you know, you have a great product. If you can figure out the numbers and make it work, you really should do it. And then I just felt really compelled to share this with people and just in a way, kind of like be like an ambassador to share the story. And then luckily when COVID hit, I said, all right, I got to do it. And I started.
And you had a corporate job.
Yes.
And then made the transition and took the leap. I think, you know, we're all lucky that you made the leap.
Oh, so thank you. So yeah, I worked in corporate America for a long time. Fortunately, the end of my career, which was actually pretty recently, I worked part-time. So that allowed me for selling my product, you know, getting things up and running. But as you know, right, you're working 7 days a week. So sometimes I would make cheese at night. I rent a commercial kitchen and I would rent it at night and I would go make cheese and I would come home at like 12, 1 in the morning. I would just make it work depending on what was happening. And now I'm full time on it.
Well, I would love to pause for a word from our sponsor at this moment, because when we come back, we're going to get into some really interesting intricacies about how we talk about food with regards to miscategorizing, I guess is the best way since I can't say it any other way. But we are going to be back with Benita in just a minute.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state.
Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
And we're back at Cutting the Curd, and hopefully I won't be stumbling over my words as we discuss the Middle Eastern / Mediterranean You can say it for me.
I don't even know if I can. The miscategorization.
Yes, thank you. That is exactly, maybe I can't say it because it really is just an issue we need to just make clear. And I also want to talk about this in the context of Ajayla Abdullah's recent article in Counterculture, yes, challenging the Eurocentrism in the cheese industry. So I know you have some feelings about the Middle Eastern / Mediterranean issue.
Yes. Yeah. So I recently did an Instagram post about this because this has been burning inside of me for years and years and years, that anytime, you know, you go out into the supermarket or you go to a restaurant, a lot of times there are products that will say Mediterranean, but they are truly Middle Eastern. So I'll give you an example, and it sounds like nothing, but it is something to us. You know, you'll see hummus, right? We don't say hummus, sorry. Hummus as Mediterranean. But in fact, I don't know if many people know this, the word hummus in Arabic means chickpea. And so it's actually an Arabic word, the word hummus. And that kind of drives us crazy, to be honest with you. It's very, very challenging. And I think that I see the supermarket as like a library. That's how I view it, right? It's like a library of ingredients. It's a library of information. And I think there hasn't been the right language put around certain types of food for a variety of reasons. I think one is fear, right, of calling it what it is. I think people think in marketing that it's better to be generic, so that way you're not sparking anything in anyone to question it. And I think there hasn't really been a brand that has been very aggressive, in a positive way, not aggressive in a negative way,
right,
to bring it to life. And I think that there's so much opportunity in grocery, and in these big, you know, stores like Whole Foods and Wegmans, for them to embrace that. And we shouldn't be afraid of it, because I think people, you know, we have an opportunity to teach people. And I think that, and you know, it's cliche, right? But when you teach people using food, it's such an easy way to learn, and people remember it. And that's what I'm finding by, you know, selling my cheese, right? When I go out and do sampling, I get a lot of faces and questions, and it's very, very interesting. And I really think that the supermarket space, especially companies, like I said, like Whole Foods and Wegmans, where I feel that they are more progressive and more open to culinary diversity, I think that there's a lot of room for them to embrace the proper words and even use merchandising and marketing as a way to, you know, bring a connection between the food and the culture. But when you think of the word Mediterranean, it's so broad and it doesn't tell you anything, right?
Right.
Like the Mediterranean runs from Europe to the Middle East. And while the Middle East runs along the Mediterranean, we really are our own cuisine, because when you eat in Syria or Lebanon, it's not going to be the same food that you're having in Italy.
Well, we have a geography problem in this country.
Oh, for sure.
You know, we're not really, I mean, you could say a lot of what we're talking about is also, you know, implicit in a lot of other subjects beyond food.
Yes. Yes,
but I think a lot of this also, and you and I talked about this when we spoke on the phone last week, you know, when we talk about names and naming things, you know, names can bring things into being. If we don't have a name for it, we can ignore it. We can overlook it. But when we name something, it gives meaning and it brings things into being. And it's not, you know, sometimes it's scary and sometimes it's wonderful and beautiful. And I you know, I think that's a lot of what you're talking about. So, and also you talked about highlighting commonalities and distinctions are okay.
Right. It's okay to say that something is just from the Middle East. It's okay to say that. And we do, there are so many common threads, right? Obviously, when you're from that part of the world, you're going to have access to ingredients that we don't have in the US, right? Like, we don't have mahlab here, right? We don't have Aleppo pepper that's from here, right? Because it's from Aleppo.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, but of course we have commonalities in terms of our ingredients, right? Like legumes, right? Like lentils, chickpeas, cannellini beans, fava beans, also nuts, right? Nuts are huge in the Middle East. Pistachios, walnuts. I mean, they are the base of majority of our desserts, our walnuts and pistachios. But at the same time, it's okay to say that this cookie that you just ate is a Middle Eastern cookie.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell people that these things are Middle Eastern. And, you know, I can't speak about myself as someone who's Syrian and not bring attention to all of those countries, right, that are around where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at history, and again, like back to your point, right, these things are not taught, right? So people don't know. But when you look at our history, someone in the past 6 months kind of brought to my attention that there's a lot of us. And I said, yeah, there are a lot of us, right? From that part of the world, from that specifically, that Eastern Mediterranean part. And I said to the person that, well, historically, that is known as the Levant region, because before it was these four countries, it was one piece of land that was then divided into Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Jordan. And that is why there are so many of us. That's why there are so many Arabic speaking people. And we share that common theme, right? Our culture is extremely similar. The religion, you know, there are Muslims, there are Christians, there are Jews. All of that is very normal to us in the Middle East. It's just here, it's not told properly. And I think, there hasn't been someone who's really pushed the conversation forward, that at least that I've seen. I don't want to say that, you know, I'm the crusader, right, but it's just, I think that it's just been lost and it gets muddied and muddied. And that's why from that part of the world, you're going to meet a lot of people who speak Arabic and who have all these common threads.
So does jibna as a cheese exist in similar forms in other parts outside what we know of as Syria?
Yes, absolutely. So I've been fortunate that I've had people who are originally from Aleppo have my product. I've had someone from Beirut, Lebanon, have my product. And I've had someone from Jerusalem have my product. And all of them have said to me, Benita, it is like I am transported back. It is the real deal. And this is a cheese that is eaten throughout that part of the world. It is a Levantine cheese. It is, you know, what people know there. It's an everyday table cheese that I would say is a little extra special because of the mahlab, because that's so unique. And it's a big part of our eating style, is having this plain white, well, what looks like plain white cheese until you eat it. It does have a lot of flavor.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't sound plain.
It
sounds
not plain.
Like it's a very charismatic cheese.
Yes.
Also, this conversation reminds me of one of my favorite interviews I've done with the creators of Lovne, which is Lovne.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, we had, you know, it was a conversation between someone from Armenia and someone from Israel, and mm-hmm. just like the commonalities in the culinary connections of a large region. And I do want to talk a little bit about what you eat, like how do you prepare a meal or a dish with gibnet? So what are some of your favorite ways, maybe something traditional and then something a little bit more contemporary that you might, you know, see at a dinner party?
Sure. So one of the very traditional ways of eating it, which is a big favorite in my house, and I love it so much, is it melted in pita bread. So the pita bread that I use is very authentic recipe. It's not what you would find at Whole Foods. It's super thin and it opens. And I cut the slices of gibnet very thin. And because it melts so well, you don't need as much as you would think because it does spread. And then I top it with dried mint, Aleppo pepper, and olive oil. And then it goes in the oven. And wow. It is the trifecta of flavor. It is so good. It's like refreshing. It's zesty. It's nutty. It's briny. It's the olive. You get the olive oil is warmed up, so you get the olive oil flavor. It's amazing. So that is like a home run. It is absolutely my favorite way of having it. And truthfully, I'm very much a purist only because I'm so traditional in my eating in terms of using gibnet. But one of the ways that you can use it is there is a recipe for something called kanafet, which is a Middle Eastern dessert. It is eaten throughout the Middle East. And some recipes call for gibnet, or you could use ricotta cheese. But if you could, yeah, you could. So in Syria, we use ricotta cheese. That's how we prepared it with my family. But you can put gibnet slices in it. And what it is a shredded phyllo dough dessert that's layered. And then you would put slices of gibnet in between. And then it goes in the oven. When it comes out, it's obviously super hot and bubbly. You would pour a simple syrup over it with cinnamon. And then when you cut into it, it creates like this like giant cheese pull.
Wow. That sounds amazing.
Yes. Yes. So the only trouble with it, and just because I want to be clear, is that reheating it can get a little tough because
no one's reheating that.
I know.
That dish is going to be
ultra.
That's yes. Inhaled.
Yes. Yes. But to be truthful to you, I like outside of, the traditional ways that I mentioned, right? Like fig jam and cantaloupe and watermelon and tomato and cucumber. I don't really venture out. And what's great about what I'm doing is once I show people the traditional ways of doing it, then they're coming back to me and telling me I did all that, but then I tried it this way. And I'm learning from them because I'm trying to keep it to the tradition, but my customers are teaching me of different ways. Like I recently heard someone say that they like it with lentils. And I was very surprised by this.
Oh, I can see that.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, like tell me more. I want to learn about lentils and gibnet. And because I wouldn't think to do that because it's not the way I grew up.
So I want to point out, because you've been talking about your customers and, mm-hmm. and the implication there is that you're interacting with people who are buying your product a lot. And I want to talk about really, you are really the face of this company. You are the company. You are out there doing the sampling, the demos. You are at events in the area.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's a 7 day a week job. So tell us about your company, Caswell's Market, and what has your growth been like? Like where do you see yourself at right now? Because are you a one woman show at this point? Because you've got a lot of fans. There's a lot of retailers in the area who are really excited about this. And so where is Caswell's Market right now? Like what's the company like?
Yeah. So right now it's just me. So I make the cheese, I package the cheese, I deliver the cheese, I do all the invoicing, all the accounting. I do everything myself. Nobody helps me. I do all my own social media, everything that you see, I do myself. And yeah, it's a lot of effort. I wish I could multiply myself and have money to hire people, but we're not there yet. But I did have a lot of growth in the past, I would say year. But yeah, I would say the past year, I'm now in 13 stores.
Including Zabar's.
Including
Zabar's. New York City people.
Yes, it's available at Zabar's, right next to the halloumi and feta cheese, if you're looking for it. And yeah, it's been incredible. And I, like you said, I do all my own demos. I try to do them as frequently as I can because it makes a difference. Because like I said earlier, people don't know. And they're so intimidated. And I didn't expect that. I think because I'm such a food lover and I'm so open to cultural foods that I just expected it to be not easy, but I just thought people would be like, oh, cool. Like I'll buy this, but that's not the case at all. So demos are so important when you're starting something new and something that's very unfamiliar. I mean, as you can imagine, if I was selling Prairie Breeze, it would be a breeze,
right.
But selling something that is foreign and, is also, you know, it's a domestically made product with an international flavor. It can have some, a little bit of a slow start. I can say that. And it does take stores some time for the uptake of the sales and for repeat customers. And that's why demos are so important. I mean, I try to demo at Zabar's at least every other month because it's so important. And honestly, we're going into 2 years I've been with them. And that connection started after my New York Times article came out. And you know, I still find new people that don't know what it is, but it does sell out, it sells out every month.
So you mentioned the New York Times article.
Yes.
You are relatively new on the scene, but you've gotten a lot of attention.
Thank you.
And the New York Times, for listeners who may not be familiar, Florence Fabricant is a writer at the New York Times who often will spotlight a cheese or a food, a location that has something exciting going on with food, or, you know, a product that she wants to highlight. What was that experience like for you?
Well, I'll tell you this. I did that because people told me not to do it. So it was a little bit of a rebellious situation. I had some conversations with people who have very successful companies. And I said, you know, what do you think I should do about like PR? And, you know, should I try? And they said, no, nobody's going to care. Literally, this is what they told me. Nobody's going to care. They go, don't bother. You don't ship your product. It's not worth your time. And no one's going to want, like, what are they going to know about you other than that you make this product? And I got to tell you, it didn't sit well with me. And I said, you know what? I'm going to try. So I don't consider myself a great writer. I put together a really well-written email to Florence Fabricant. And in the subject line, I wrote, because I knew she's in New York City, I said, there's a new cheese in town. Have you tried it? And then I introduced myself. I told her about my product and what I do and where I'm from. And I just put it out in the universe. And I waited. And then one day, 6 weeks later, I get an email from her. And she's like, hi, Benita, I'm sorry I didn't get back to you sooner. I'd love to try your product. And, you know, should I run to Ideal Cheese Shop and get it? And I replied right away. I was like I was literally sweating. And I said, no. I'm like, I'll bring it to you. I'm coming to the city. I'll drop it off to you. So she had responded and she said, well, I'm out of town, but you know, you can drop it off with my doorman. And I ran home so fast. And I got my stuff together and I went to the city and I dropped it off with her doorman.
Amazing.
And then I waited. So a couple of days went by and then she responded to me and said, all she said was, you're going to hear from my team. You're going to be in the New York Times next week. And that was it. And I was blown away. I could not believe it.
Amazing.
And it was a huge, huge moment. And I was so excited. I was like, how did this happen? Like I did make it happen, but the fact that she was excited to do it or happy to do it, or she enjoyed it, it blew my mind.
That's incredible. You know, there's like different like levels of like, you know, a previous guest had called it pinch me moments.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And that was it.
Yeah. And what I find is so fascinating, even when we were talking about outreach to customers, there's always more customers. There's always more people to expose to your product or to educate about GibNet and about the middle, you know, the distinction between Middle Eastern and Mediterranean, and also some of the commonalities, and like maybe pulling out a map so people see like, this is how water and trade routes and like, you know, like connected us, you know, historically. Yeah. And so I think it's wild. And to think that you're just in the beginning, this is just the beginning.
Yeah. So, it's just the beginning. It's really, really incredible. And back to your point about customers, I will tell you one of the joys of doing demos is that, you know, you see people's reaction, right? So a lot of times I don't tell people right away that I'm the owner and I'm the maker. I wait because I don't want people to feel that they have to be nice, and tell me that they love it. So when I do demos, I just typically say, oh, this is a product available at Zabar's and it's Syrian cheese. And these are the roots. And this is what it would taste like. Like if you like feta cheese or halloumi, I think you'll like it. And I'll tell them about the ingredients and then they have it. And then, when they're like, oh my gosh, it's so good. I say, oh, thank you so much. I make it myself. And then they're blown away. And then the look starts, right? Like it's either confusion. They're like, well, how do you know how to make this? Are you from Syria? And, a lot of times I tell them I'm from Syria. You know, there's a look of compassion, which I appreciate. Sometimes, you know, it's not so nice. I've had situations where people have not been nice to me.
I wanted to ask you, but I also didn't want to ask you.
It's okay. Because, you can ask me. I think it's important. I really do. And I'm so open to talking about anything.
Right.
You know, I did have a customer yell at me at the store, talking about, you know, your people, your government, you're this, you're that. And, you know, it definitely caught me off guard. Other customers were there and they kind of like shielded me from him. He did step back. He wasn't like in my face, but you know, it happens. And, you know, unfortunately I expect it to happen. Unfortunately. Mm-hmm. You know, I always know that there is a chance of that. But I have to persevere and it's okay. If they do that, that just shows their ignorance and I can't be afraid of that. And it's so important. And, you know, I've had so many moments where, people have said to me, oh my gosh, my grandmother was Lebanese and she used to make this. And I've had so many things like that happen. I had a woman who, if you saw her, she likely might've been of like German descent, and, she was so nice to me. And after we spoke, she said to me, I have to tell you, my husband was Syrian and I'm on my way to my daughter's, new house to celebrate. And I was stopping here to pick up some stuff from Zabar's and I feel like I was meant to meet you. Oh. And she hugged me. And I've had a lot of that too. I've had people cry. So I get a lot of reaction. And, so I really never know what I'm going to get when I'm at the stores. It could be people are upset with you. People could say things that are not friendly, and out of ignorance. And, but like I said, I push through those moments and I just feel privileged that I can do this right now. And I can, like I said, be this like small ambassador to that part of the world, because for me, it's not just about Syria. It's about the region in general. Mm-hmm. Because for me, when I meet someone who's from Lebanon or Jordan or Palestine, to me, we're all the same. Doesn't matter their religion. To me, you know, our common thread is that we were one land and then we were divided, and maybe our dialects are a little bit different now, but overall our food is the same. Our dancing is the same. Our, you know, culturally our habits are the same. And that's what really drives me.
I also want to add, and your joy is the same.
Yes.
And I think that cheese brings so much joy to people for so many of the reasons you laid out. And food can do that, the power of food and sharing a meal. I don't really have anything more to say, because you have said everything so powerfully.
Thank you. I just think there's just so much more opportunity, for, you know, like I said, like these really more progressive supermarkets to do more.
Right.
But everything's a first step, and, you know, I see that they are taking steps, but I don't think we're there yet.
Right. Well, yeah. Rising tides raise all ships.
Yeah, absolutely. There is absolutely.
On the cheese counter for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So I want to give you a chance to tell people where they can find your Gibnet. And if they're not local, what about your website? Can they just even learn about more about you and your cheese?
Yeah. So my product is available. All the stores are listed on my website, which is kasbosmarket.com. It's kasbosmarket.com. So stores like, Gary's Wine and Liquor in Madison, they have another location in Bernardsville, as well as Wayne. Also, Van Hook Cheese in Montclair, Wine Library in Springfield. That's been a new one for me. They've been fantastic. And also Zabar's, like we said. Outside of the stores that are in my area, I do shipping. I ship in the Northeast, so I'll ship to Boston. I've shipped, we can ship to Rhode Island. That has to be done through DM and coordinated properly because it's perishable and it has to stay cold. So mm-hmm. If someone's interested in doing that, they can send me a message through my website. And then if you are not in the area and you want to try to experience some type of Middle Eastern cheese, what I would say is, you know, Google Middle Eastern communities and see if there's a store maybe, you know, 15, 20 minutes from you, to try to find a product similar to mine. You know, there are big pockets of Middle Eastern people in Ohio, in Michigan, in California, 100%. There's a lot of them. And I think that you can find it. It may not taste exactly like mine, but that's okay. But that's what I would say is a good way to find it.
Thank you so much for joining Cutting the Curd today and speaking with me. And I'm lucky because I get to meet you in person soon.
I can't wait.
That's a story for another time. But yeah, I'm really happy that you were able to record with me today. And everyone, you know, definitely visit kasbosmarket.com. Thank you again, Benita Kasbo.
Thank you so much for having me. And maybe after we meet, we could have a follow-up podcast so you could talk about what you think about the cheese.
Oh my gosh, I love that idea. I love that idea.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, everyone, you can always follow us at Cutting the Curd on Instagram and at heritageradionetwork.org. You can also find us on your favorite streaming platforms. And please leave us a review, leave us some stars. It helps people find us and it makes everybody feel good. And I will see you again soon.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola El Waley, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.